So then, it is 3:30, and this is the almost the last session, second to last session of the conference or session slot, and I'll be talking about building hybrid applications on and with Windows Azure. And I'll define what hybrid applications are, and then I'll show you a number of technologies and kind of architectural approach for how to do that. My name is Clemens. I work on the Service Bus team, or now the Windows Azure Mobile Workload, as it's called. We actually recently reorganized our teams, and now there's no longer a Service Bus team and a mobile services team, but we're one big happy family. And we're taking care of, at the core, about mobile devices and also embedded devices, but also the enterprise-focused, integration-focused mission of Service Bus. Is going to continue in that team as well. So I work in that team, in the Redmond team, but I'm based in Germany, so I'm actually not so far away from you guys. So before I talk about hybrid, let's first define what hybrid means. Hybrid, as we understand it, because there are 400,000 different definitions, is any app where you have one or more tier, service or component hosted in IaaS or PaaS. So you have a piece of software that runs in the cloud, but that might be a public cloud or might be a private cloud, some environment that is now together with, operates together with another piece of software which runs somewhere else. That might be on someone's computer, right, personal PC, that might be on someone's server under a desk, that might be in someone's data center. So hybrid is when a normal app spans or shares functionality and collaborates with an application that sits in IaaS or PaaS. Another case studies or things that I want to walk you through, a few at the beginning and then a few a little later where I'll do a bit of a recap of what I talked about in my Service Bus session. So let's talk about EasyJet first. EasyJet wanted to reduce its dependence on expensive airport service desk technology and better serve customers by equipping roving agents with mobile devices. To give you a little bit more of an insight of that story, when you are at an airport and you want to provide service at an airport and there's a and you stand somewhere at an airport and you stand there for five minutes, someone is going to charge you because you stand on that place for 5 minutes. That's how airports operate. They're renting out everything that they can to the airlines, and that's how they make their money. So one of the things that airlines rent are these terminals. So when you go to the airport and you check in, there are these computers behind those desks. They're not owned by the airlines. Some of them are. But commonly for smaller airlines, that EasyJet, that's infrastructure that exists at the airport. And they can rent that. And they're renting this together with not only the terminal, but actually also the software system that sits behind this. And that's how they perform their check-ins. Now, doing that is actually very expensive in two ways. First of all, they have to rent that equipment, and they have to rent these desks. And that is expensive per se, because the airport charges for using those terminals. Second, because they're actually integrating with a system, they have to go and now do the back-end integration between that system and their own systems. So that's another expense. So EasyJet effectively is EasyJet as a company is effectively a small IT company, a few hundred people, with a lot of airplanes. So they have a lot of corporate jets, and they're so nice to let you fly on it. And so they have, a few thousand people who are actually pilots and flight attendants and service people. But the core of the company is really an IT company. And so what they're thinking about is how can we make aviation, how can we make flying cheaper for people and more efficient? How can we make more money? And so one of the things that they're doing is they're using IT for that. So what they did is they took the assets that they already had for EasyJet.com, which is their website. And what you can do at the website, as you can do with very many other airlines, you can check in on the website. So you go type in your booking number, booking code, and your name, and you can go and check in. So And it's possible that everybody who goes on a flight actually checks in on the website. So you have nobody left to check in at the airport. So they were thinking about this, and they're like, maybe we can actually do this in a similar fashion, and instead of having, you know, checking people in through the website, maybe we can bring mobile devices into the airport, our own terminals, with a card reader and with a printer, and we can probably do all that servicing through our own infrastructure. So they went and exposed their own services that they have in their own data center, exposed them out to the public internet, and they first did that as a POC, as a proof of concept. And so they sat down, Bert Craven at EasyJet sat down, and did that with his team, and it took them 20 minutes to go and take these internal facing web services and expose them out into Windows Azure, using Windows Azure as a demilitarized zone for those services. And then those mobile devices, which are at the airport, connected through the Vodafone network, can, so they're on normal 3G, they can now go and talk to the edge, that DMZ that is now in Windows Azure, and back to their services. The devices can also synchronize each other using queues, so using the PubSub infrastructure that we have, so that you can go and coordinate who has given who which seat. But all of a sudden, with that, they were able to declare independence effectively from that terminal infrastructure. What that also enables them to do is, because they now have effectively completely mobile check-in infrastructure, they can go to, you know, a wonderful place on a Greek island, or they can go a wonderful place here or there, and they can go and set up operations for a week or two in the summer months, you know, check in people, do all those things with effective pop-up airline model, and then you know, collect all those things and move on again until next year. So it makes them very agile and very flexible to do it that way. But for that, they have now a hybrid application where they have field-deployed clients which need to talk to each other and which need to talk to back-end services. And those back-end services were not originally built to be exposed in that way, and they're doing that using Windows Azure. Now, they actually did the analysis of whether it would be cheaper to go and take those web services which are built in the infrastructure and pull them out to their own data center edge. And that work would be this versus the 20 minutes it took them to change the configuration plus paying us a little bit of money. Doing that in their own data center, basically just taking that service and pulling it up and making, securing it, and then doing all that work to expose that there, would have cost them much, much more money than they've ever paid us. So that paid off. So they have a hybrid story where they have a much better, much more agile approach now, but they're using their own services, stuff that they have on premises, and they enable them with extra, with Windows Azure Service Bus, and also having now, once they've done that step, they have now extra services that they use on the cloud. What's an interesting story here is that that was not planned. So the EasyJet folks told us very clearly, we didn't want to do this. They went in, and since they're a very innovative company, they were considering 4 years or 5 years ago, what is our cloud strategy? Because they could see that coming, that wave. So they were like, how can we benefit from the cloud? And so they took the approach that everybody else did and said, okay, so how can we go and approach this? Let's see what we have in services. So backup storage would be something that's logical, right? So they wanted to do backup storage and all those things. And then they charted out a plan what they wanted to do. And they said, well, airside, this is airside. Airside meaning everything that's core airline operations. We're going to not get there in 8 years, 7 years, because they didn't have that on the radar. And then they came around with this POC initially, and then with actually deploying it. And so their cloud strategy, to their own surprise, started exactly at the opposite end of the spectrum as they expected it. They started with their core business operations and then are now eventually moving the other way. So cloud, embracing the cloud, like if you're go at it with an open mind about what you can do with it, can actually be fairly surprising and actually yield very surprising results. So who needs and builds hybrid solutions? So what we've done in the recent year, we've talked to over 700 US enterprises. We're doing those things in the US because. And so we talked to 700 US enterprises who are building new applications for their businesses. So these are enterprises per se who are building applications for their own use or have them built for them. Almost half of all new applications are actually already built as hybrid applications where some piece runs in the cloud and some piece runs on premises. Almost half, about 46%. Over 50% of all new business apps have at least some kind of cloud dependency. So there's new apps are built specifically as hybrid, and then over 50% of apps have some kind of dependency on some cloud service. Of these new apps, 60% are brand new, 20% are rewrites of existing stuff, and 20% are enhancements of existing applications. So what we're seeing is that this notion of hybrid, this notion of building applications that are both touching cloud systems and on-premises systems is something that's actually with a predominant application model when you think about new applications that are being built, which is fairly interesting. So what we see is that that customers are actively embracing cloud technologies, but to varying degrees. So there are actually, the reason why people are building hybrid apps versus just pure cloud apps is that reality gets in the way. There are cases where, just like here in EasyJet, you need to have your compute near where you do your business. Right? You need to have that device in your hands as you're checking in the customer. You can't do that in the cloud. If you have a self-service machine, like I talked about this DVD rental story, right, in the service bus talk, well, you need to be right there. If you want to integrate a vehicle, like a truck, into and you want to integrate that with web services, well, then you'll have to be present there in the truck. So there's a lot of scenarios where you just have to be hybrid by the nature of things. And then there's also on the other side where you have pure IT systems, like let's say a CRM system, customer relationship management system, or an ERP system. Those are just big databases, effectively, big database editing systems. But even those are often run as hybrid because there's data in there which you cannot have in the cloud based on regulation. Because there's a technology aspect to the cloud where I can tell you how secure we are, right? And we believe that we actually are very secure. And I'm going to go through some of those aspects. But if the regulator tells you that you cannot have financial data of a particular kind in a public cloud, then you'll have to find a solution for how to leverage the cloud in one way, but have that personal data sitting somewhere else. And then you need to go and build a system that kind of touches both. So you have two deployment choices. One is go into the public cloud and go into the private cloud. Private cloud is effectively a model for self-service, automated deployment of machines. It's not pure virtualization. It's actually a step further from virtualization. It is allowing you to go and effectively have teams, have employees self-manage the provisioning of compute resources. So you provide the capacity, you provide that basic cloud, private cloud infrastructure, and then you can have teams or employees go and self-provision infrastructure as they need it. And then, of course, public is that same version but run by someone else, not your own company, but, for instance, by Microsoft. And then you can also deploy across both models, some in public, some in private. The interesting thing between private cloud and public cloud is the economics of that story. In the public cloud, if you think about the number of servers in a data center, the more servers you put into a data center, the cheaper it gets to run that data center. So we have these mega data centers that we run. We have the ones in Texas and in Illinois and in Dublin and in Amsterdam. And more of those, also in Hong Kong, et cetera, our data centers. And most of these are mega facilities. They're absolutely amazingly large. If you make them so big, the advantage is you can set them up in a clever, more energy and cooling efficient way, just in general, but just because of the, you can build special structures for them, and you can build near cheap energy. You also have obviously more buying power. If you go to a hardware supplier and say, I want to have 50,000 or 100,000 machines, you get a better deal than you know, if you buy fewer. So if you are running, in, and also the capacity management is something that is better, or capacity utilization is something that's better in public cloud, because you have many customers sharing the same set of resources, which also drives the cost down. So overall, the difference between public cloud and private cloud is the, you know, complete scale, and then also the cost, because it's dedicated capacity. The interesting thing here is that most of the companies, and that's coming here, most of the companies actually have a don't even have approach that scale. Most of the biggest enterprises have up to 1,000 servers. There's only a few, I think 50 or so, 50 to 100 companies, which actually run more than 10,000 servers. So even the largest companies in the world don't run something that's approaching the scale of what we run, and what Google runs, and what Amazon runs, and then you think of the dedicated website offers like Facebook, what they run. But there are only like a handful, two handful of companies who are actually approaching the scale of 100,000. The interesting thing is, because we run 100,000, we can now give you the price for running 100,000. And when you look at the prices, and another thing to look at, when you look at the prices that we have, and when you look at the prices that are offered with just shared colo hosting and all those things, what we give you when we give you a VM is not a basically just a VM that sits somewhere in a rack, as you get with colo or with traditional hosting, but you get a thing that has three times redundant disk, and you get a thing that actually has a way to go and deploy it to someone else, where we can move that around in capacity. It's not that your machine dies and then your machine has downtime, but we actually give you uptime guarantees and all those things. That's something that is, you know, modern data center style capacity. So if you are looking at this model, if you look at it from a energy, you know, running the system perspective, plus acquisition of the hardware, we have a big advantage of in public cloud, and you can see that in the pricing that you'll see with, you know, Google and Amazon and us. If you're an enterprise and you actually run the numbers, you can see up to 10 times benefit of running a workload in the cloud, in the public cloud, versus running it in your own facilities. If you're a small and medium business, you can see over 25 times the benefit. If you are, let me say that more pronounced. I believe that if you are a company of a size of, you know, 10, 15, 50 people, and you run your own Exchange and your own SharePoint, you're stupid. Or you have lost your calculator. Because it's impossible to run Office, the Office servers, at a price point that gets even close to Office 365. Because the advantage is so significantly huge. Just running that infrastructure, buying a server and running it, just 24 hours, if you just count what the electricity costs, it's absurd. You should not run that yourself, and we can do that much more efficiently, so that's why we're doing it, and that's how you get the benefits. Small and medium businesses can instantly today benefit from the cloud because of that economy. So we'll have this IT continuum where we start from physical, and that's where we started effectively. That's where we were a few years ago, and then went to just virtualization, to better utilization of the servers, because people understood that if you pack more workloads onto a machine, and the machine's utilization gets better, so you can go and utilize your workloads better. Because a standard server that sits in an enterprise sits under 10% utilization usually, and so it's just generally bored. So you take a bunch of bored servers, virtualize them together, put them on the physical machine, and what that gives you is a physical machine that's less bored. But in virtualization, you still treat the physical machines and what's on them virtually like pets. That's an analogy that I've heard on, I think, on Twitter a few weeks ago, and I just like this. So with pure virtualization, your servers are pets. You know their name, you know where they are, and you care about them. When you think about IaaS, infrastructure as a service, they're cattle. The physical machines are cattle. They're not, they have numbers, and you don't care what they are, and if someone goes and rips them out of the rack, you don't care. They become cattle. Pets, virtualization, IaaS, cattle. Because you don't care. What you care about is that you have a virtualized, effectively that they have a virtualized machine image. The disk is what counts. The persistence is what counts. And that you have some place to run that thing. And that you have some way to go and identify that thing. But you don't care about that physical hardware anymore. And actually, we don't. We run this in a way that we have these containers, which are racks. I'm going to show you a video, actually. And those machines run unattended. Well, they are managed by our system. And if a machine dies, it dies. And just sits there dead in the rack. And only if there's enough machines dead in that rack, then we actually go there and pull them all out and service them. And then you go further in PaaS, and PaaS you don't care about the individual machine anymore, you only care about your app. And in SaaS, you are really only caring about solution and not about any of that stuff that sits on top of it. Windows Azure covers IaaS and PaaS. So, what we would like everybody to use, because that's easy to manage, that's easier to manage for us, and arguably also yields the easier architectures for you to run, is cloud services, PaaS, or Windows Azure websites, also PaaS. So we give you a nice abstraction over the actually concrete operating system. We give you a bit of a jail to put your applications into, and with that you can much easier build very scalable apps, because we give you a basic architectural notion of how you can build those. There's some constraints in the system, but if you follow those constraints, your applications will scale quite nicely. So the way that works, and we'll talk about I'll get back to hybrid, no worries. The way that works is I go and take a service package and upload that up into the cloud, and then I go and provision some role instances in the system. So I now reserve VMs out of that pool, and I go and take that service package, and they're part of the big, in the Windows Azure Data Center, obviously, and I take that package and deploy it automatically. And then I configure the network load balancer for you. And so now you can go and talk to those machines. And if one of those machines gets in trouble and dies or doesn't respond properly, we're going to go and make a new one, take the old one out of service, and put that new one in service. And that's all automated. Why we personally like, so we, my team, Service Bus, we're sitting on top of cloud services because we like all of that. We don't have to worry about this. We don't have to worry about the machines. We just say, I want to have 15 roles or 16 instances of this role, and the Fabric controller just goes, does that for us. So that's a great advantage of running in the cloud, and these are things that you can also leverage for your own applications as you build them and as you connect things to, as you build new extensions to existing applications. That's something that is much easier in the cloud than it is on premises. Today, to do the things that we are doing here, so what I just showed you, right, make a package, allocate 4 VMs out of a pool of VMs, deploy the application, and run the application, and then, you know, replace a running instance with a new running instance with that new code. If you had to go and script all this, that would take you a long, long time. It took us 3 years to do that. You don't have to write that code anymore. We've written that for you. Virtual machines, is where everybody kind of starts in the cloud. And we just announced the general availability of virtual machines. So that's a huge step for Windows Azure, and obviously one that we should have taken much, much earlier. But we have believed, leadership has believed, in the beginning that using cloud services would be something that would be a logical thing for all developers to embrace. Turns out, you have existing workloads that are existing apps that you want to go and run in the cloud that are not fitting into that constraint bucket of cloud services. So we give you virtual machines. Effectively, what we give you is Windows Server or Linux, or effectively anything that runs on x86. We'll also give you virtual private networking. So I'm going to explain those two. So first of all, if you have a Hyper-V image, Hyper-V compatible image, we can run it. So you make a VHD. That VHD, if you can boot that on Hyper-V, you can boot it in the cloud. That's very important. So let me show that. You go and have your own data center. You have Windows Azure, and you have your virtual machines that are running in your own place. So you have Hyper-V in place, and you're running workloads on top of Hyper-V. You can actually go and take those images as they are, mostly, and just move them up into Windows Azure. There's some configuration involved, obviously, because you're moving them into a different environment. But if those machines were kind of standalone, that's the easiest thing you can do. So you can configure a machine locally, and you can go and upload it and move it to Windows Azure. So to be frank, that might take a little bit longer than on the slide. Because if you make a disk, and that disk is 500 gigabytes large, it will take you quite a bit of time to actually upload this. So you should be mindful of what you actually need to put into that image before you upload it, because that's going to cost you some time. We're actually considering having some new options to go and get huge amounts of data into the cloud. But for now, you'll probably have to do it that way with a traditional upload. So don't put the data onto that image if you can avoid it, but put all the stuff that you need to install on that image. You can also pull these VMs back in. So if you run them in Windows Azure, and then you can go and pull those images back into your own data center if you want to. So if you don't like what we're doing, if you don't like our service, if you think we're not reliable enough, and you want to take that back, you can go and do that. And if you decide that you like Amazon more, or someone else more, and they accept the Hyper-V images, I think Amazon does, well, then you can go and move that image also over to Amazon. The point here is the IaaS infrastructure is built so that there's absolutely no lock-in. You build your applications. Right, you deploy them as you have deployed them on the cloud. If you build on infrastructure as a service, and you have agility to go into our cloud, to go into someone else's cloud, or go back into your own infrastructure. So agility is one key point here. There is really, for running things in Windows Azure, there is no lock-in. And that's something that a lot of customers are insisting on. Also, when you have a global workload, when you need to go and run things in several countries. In some countries, it might be tenable to go and run in Windows Azure. In other countries, because of regulations, it might not be. Well, you have the flexibility, because you can go and choose that you run in a colo in one place, that you run in the cloud in someone else's place, and that you run your own data center in your own facility in yet another country. And obviously, you pay only for what you use, and this is actually getting better. We're going to announce some things in that direction at TechEd next week, how we can make actually the IaaS billing a little bit more organized. We have a bunch of services, obviously, in Windows Azure. There's something cut off here. Let me do that again. Nope. Well, this is Microsoft.net. Sorry. And we have effectively a layered system here that we have. We have this global physical infrastructure. We have this network that is we have a global network that's owned by Microsoft. We have points of presence, kind of switch points in very many places. Then we have all these services. I talked so far about compute services. So cloud services and IaaS are compute services. And then we have a number of storage services. We have the SQL database. We have a NoSQL database, a table store. We have blob storage. Then we have kind of storage slash compute. We have Hadoop, HD Insight. It's currently in preview. And then we have a number of networking capabilities that kind of bridge. I'm going to talk about those in a moment. And then we have some extra capabilities like Service Bus that I work on and some other services that also will help you building applications that run both here and both there. And obviously, you have on that platform a choice of whatever language you and runtime you want to use. Not only in IaaS, but also in the cloud services, we have first-class support for, and also web service, first-class support for PHP, Node. We're a large contributor to Node. We're working very closely with the Node community, and Python and Java. And we're taking those things very seriously. We have dedicated teams who are building these SDKs for those different platforms, and they're not doing that as a hobby. I think in the early, probably the first 2 years, that we were building Windows Azure, we kind of have done that as a hobby, all the other languages, and we're focusing on .NET, and now that has really shifted. And .NET is one of the languages, certainly still the most important one that we have, but we're also taking platforms like Node very, very seriously because a lot of people are building solutions on top of those. So, and now my machine. There we go. All right. So let's take a look at some of the properties of Windows Azure, like compare them with your own capabilities that you might have in your own data centers. Because when we talk about hybrid applications, it's not about just the doing of, you know, connect things up, and but you also need to go and trust the platform. So let me tell you what we're doing in Windows Azure in terms of operating the platform and what we kind of do as and what guarantees that we give. So that you can assess whether it's we're actually a worthy place for your applications to run in. So first of all, we have state-of-the-art security and access control. Getting into our data centers is enormously difficult, and you'll probably have to bring a tank, and then someone might be shooting at you. So we have state-of-the-art access control in our buildings. I'm a Microsoft employee. I probably can't even get into the lobby of the data center. So we have very few people who are authorized to actually get into the facilities, get near them, and you know, it's smart card plus lock code plus I don't know how many things that they have in place there. 200 plus services delivered. 200 plus services inside of Windows Azure that we have now. They're delivered obviously 24/7. 99.9% availability assurance across all those services. Some have a little bit more. And we're operating on top of GFS. You can go to globalfoundationservices.org, I think it is, or .com. Global Foundation Services is Microsoft's data center operations. They have their own website. And so you can go and take a look at what they do in terms of power efficiency. But as we go from data center generation to data center generation, we try to make them more and more and more power efficient and to use more and more of that power for actual compute. In many data center facilities, most of the power that you spend is all for cooling and for auxiliary things and not really for compute. What we're aiming to is maximize the utilization of compute. And we're doing things like effectively having airy data center buildings where the outside air can flow through the entire building so that we don't have to spend as much on cooling. Because if we're in a place where we can actually go and use that for cooling and we can keep the machines cooler than about 70 degrees Celsius, we're okay. So even in places where it's notoriously hot, we can actually use the outside air to cool them. And so that's what we're doing. 2,000 plus people in engineering, $2.3 billion investments in cloud infrastructure that we're doing around the world, and it's growing and growing. So that's kind of as a start. Here's a look into some of our facilities. That is Chicago. That's the inside of one of those containers. And so those containers you see, they contain these racks, they contain these computers, and they're being moved in there, and you see those rows of machines there. That's where your stuff lives. That's how it's connected. So that's the Chicago, that's a generation two data center facility that we have there. And so that's when you select US North, that's where you go into. That's one of the data center models. We have a few other ones. But the key here is that these containers are being filled and being maintained by vendors. So we have the likes of, I won't tell you who that is, but think of companies like Dell or HP. And they're configuring kind of these containers, and we will usually not go in them. Sometimes we do. But they're operated lights out. We don't care about the machines, as I said, cattle. That's how we care, that's why we treat them. And if a certain number of machines have been are dead or too old, we'll replace them and move in another container. That's basically how that works. So this is where your stuff runs. So the containers are closed, you can't get into the facility, and it is also a very impressively clean place. These containers here get connected with power and water for cooling and network. The Gen 3, so the newest ones, they are so-called IT packs. Here we don't have modular power infrastructure yet. In the newer data centers, we have modular power infrastructure. We have these containers are now replaced by IT packs that don't need to be cooled from the outside in that way, or through using water this way, because the air can actually flow through them. So that's what I mentioned earlier. So that's state-of-the-art facilities. Then we have multiple data centers in different geographies. Currently, there's 8 data centers. We have announced another 6 in Australia, 2 in China, 2 and in Japan, 2. So that brings that then up to 14, if I calculate that right. And that's not everything. I think there's more announcements coming in that direction. So we're rapidly going up in the kinds of data centers. And every place where there's enough economic value in actually being that place, there's a good chance that there's a data center. So I wouldn't rule that out over time, for instance, also for Russia. There's geo-replication. That's a principle that we have as a basic requirement for all our services, that you need to be able to geo-replicate your data. So Service Bus, for instance, if you were creating a namespace in Europe West, then that namespace, that data that's associated with that, automatically gets replicated into Europe North. The reason why we're doing that is if Amsterdam, where Europe West is, would be flooded for some reason, then, well, I'm German and they're Dutch, but we still like each other. So if that would get flooded for some reason or something else would happen, then we can actually go and declare bankruptcy on the entire data center, move out to the North data center in Dublin, and let that effectively take over all the Amsterdam capacity also. So there's actually reserves in these data centers mutually, so that one could take over the job of the other one. So that's what geo-replication is, and then redundancy and failover. So we can actually fail an entire data center with everything that's in there over to another data center with your data. So as said, we have these 8 data centers, soon to be 14 data centers, plus the CDN nodes in the system, and that's a growing platform. 99.95% uptime, that's for compute. Storage, Service Bus, and some other services have 99.9% uptime. Financially backed SLAs means that you pay less, or we actually pay something back if we miss that SLA. And that is something, and we have effectively great security in place. We do continuous testing. We follow the Microsoft Secure Development Lifecycle, as you should also do if you care. Microsoft.com/SDL. That's something that we follow the procedures there. And lastly, what we're also doing is we have the facilities externally verified by auditors based on a number of standards to make sure that not only I can stand up here and tell you we're doing those things right, but that the independent auditors actually verify that that's actually the truth. So we have a number of compliance things going on. So we have ISO 27001. We are following the rules of the EU Data Protection Initiative. We have a certification for the US healthcare HIPAA, the Business Associate Agreement, and FISMA Federal, that's for the US federal government. And we're also working with governments around the world to make sure that their compliance regulations are also respected. I don't know whether anything is going on in Russia about this, but that's something that is certainly in the cards that we can go and start working on those things. The base services are currently certified, and we're working to fill out that grid over time. If you want to know more about those security things, those certifications, what we have, go to the Trust Center. That's in windowsazure.com under support. You find the Trust Center, and that's where all the stories are about privacy and about certifications and all those things. And that does matter if we're hosting your applications. So now I've talked about Windows Azure kind of in the abstract, kind of with an eye on hybrid applications and your apps that are run in our data centers, and that it might be, we might run a data center operation that's worthy of your data. Let's talk about some hybrid concepts and probably some hybrid recipes. The reason why people build hybrid IT, hybrid apps, is greater efficiency, right? Reduce time to solution because it's very easy to provision that infrastructure. If you want to deploy a solution, you need to have 10 machines now. Well, we have them. You don't, but we have them. So instead of you ordering them and having them shipped and waiting for them, well, just come to us and just grab 10. And you can get those within the matter of, you know, 5 minutes. So that's certainly a gain. If you need to go and deliver something rapidly, we have that capacity for you. If you are enabling customers and the customer needs to have a server to do something, if you do that in the cloud, you can deliver something from, you know, the phone call to having a system set up probably in a day. You can't do that if you do that on premises. Scale is a big thing. We have a number of customers who are using Windows Azure to kind of scale out operations on a seasonal basis. If you're in retail and you're selling things online, your biggest time of the year is typically around Christmas. And so you want to go and have extra capacity around Christmas, but you don't want to have all those servers sitting around gathering dust the whole year. Actually, that's one of the motivations that got Amazon to thinking about cloud computing, because they had all this extra capacity that they only needed for the holidays, and how do you use that? Well, selling it to other people was a logical idea, at least if you think about it with the benefit of hindsight. So you want to have extra capacity, you want to go and scale out, well then using the cloud is a good thing. And also trying to go and to balance performance with cost, and you don't want to have all that iron sitting around not doing anything. So there's effectively three models: traditional, private, pooled virtualization that I talked about in public, and hybrid applications. They're kind of bridging the gap between them, where the cloud piece is the most efficient one, the one that's using all the benefits of the cloud, and then the existing things are systems that you have run, that you are running already, and that you don't want to move because of complexity, because of investment protection, et cetera, et cetera. So the public story is Windows Azure. The private story is Windows Server with Hyper-V for us. And let's talk about the things that are hybrid, where the bridges are, because that's the question. Once you now you have two environments that you got to think about, what are the things that help you bridge between them? The first one, and arguably one of the most important ones, is identity. With identity is who are my users in the enterprise? And that's something which the vast majority of companies today solve with Active Directory. Active Directory is the way how users are being provisioned, users are being managed. Active Directory is that. We have now, so that's Windows Server Active Directory. We have now in Windows Azure, Windows Azure Active Directory. And what Windows Azure Active Directory allows you to do is to federate with the on-premises version of Windows Azure Directory and actually project the users that you have on Windows Azure, on your own Active Directory, project them out into Windows Azure. Which means that now you can build applications that run in the cloud which use the same identities and which actually can do single sign-on from your corporate environments into the cloud by ways of using Windows Azure Active Directory. So you have a single identity, and it feels exactly the same as in your own network. Single sign-on, you can go and effectively what happens in that environment is the application gets to your, the user gets to your app, the app says no token, it redirects to Windows Azure Active Directory. Windows Azure Active Directory redirects to your internal Active Directory, and the user can see both. It will go and then pick up the Kerberos token from your client, present that to the local Active Directory. It will give you a token that presents it to that Active Directory, and then we'll go back to your app. All that magic is done with a few clicks. Your application only needs to know that it federates with Active Directory. It needs to understand the particular token, but that's something that is all kind of baked into the SDKs that are covered with that. So identity is the first big thing to think about, and we have a solution for that. Windows Azure Active Directory together with Active Directory now allow you to have a common identity story across cloud and on-premises. Virtualization. That's the same story that I told earlier in other slides. Right? You make a VM, you run it locally. If you want to move it to the cloud, you can. Management. We have management so this is something that developers usually don't know about because who cares about System Center? But from a management side, if you're sitting with IT pros, it's a wholly different story because they live in that. So what you can do is you can manage Windows Azure VMs just as well as you can manage private VMs through common infrastructure. So you can use System Center to go and operate both of them. And that's one of the goals, that we have a common view of all those systems, whether they run in your environment or in our environment. And System Center provides one operational view across them. And then obviously development, which we care about, is the goal is for us to make these environments as similar as we can make them. So we're moving in both directions, and since we are moving effectively cloud first, is we're trying to make the tooling similar on the server as we have it in the cloud. We're kind of building new, when we build out new tooling, we build out new environments, we start in the cloud and we move them down to the server. So you're seeing this already. We have Windows Azure websites is available for hosters already. So you can actually go and host Windows Azure websites yourself in your own environment if you are a hosting company. And you can expect that trend to continue so that the pieces of infrastructure that you find in Windows Azure are also going to be available for the private cloud for your own environments. Another example of that is Service Bus. Right? Service Bus exists as a cloud deployed infrastructure, as a PaaS infrastructure, but you can also download it and run it on your own data center, on your own servers. But it takes a little bit more effort. But setting it up and running it. But for an application developer, you could target the same kinds of services, whether you're on private environments or whether you're in a public environment. That's ultimately what matters. What we believe is that we can run those things much cheaper than you can yourself. So from an economic perspective, it will almost always be advantageous for you to run in the public cloud. And the reason why you might not want to run in the public cloud are typically not technical, but rather regulatory. Right, or a matter of trust, so you can't go out because the data is too valuable and you're too worried about it. The security layers we have in the system are fairly, we have a number of layers. So first of all, physical security, that's audited, as I said earlier. We have the network is managed, is segmented in a way that, and virtualized in a way that these deployments, when you create a Windows Azure deployment that's separated, very hard separated between the between any all of the other environments. So we're creating effectively VPNs, if you will, VPN-style environments inside that data center to isolate them. The host is a customized, the host machine that everything runs on is a somewhat customized version of Windows Server that's a little bit more efficient. And we're actually bringing those innovations back into Windows Server so it becomes the same thing. And so the host boundaries between the VMs are enforced by that supervisor that runs. And then we have the application layer, you know, a Windows account that runs the PaaS stuff that has low privileges. And of course, you can run the .NET framework if you run .NET framework code under partial trust. So there's a layered approach to the security infrastructure that we have in place. We're taking that enormously serious because if someone breaches our data centers, everybody will be unhappy and everybody will be moving out. So it's in our own best interest to go and protect all those assets optimally. For connecting things between cloud and on-premises, we have a number of options. I'm going to run through a bunch of them. And of course, the last thing I'm going to talk about is Service Bus, because I work on that. So the first option is the virtual network. The virtual network is a service that's also newly available as a generally available capability. And that allows you to go and take two sites and map them together into the same network. So what you can do is you can go and set up a router. We ship configuration scripts for Juniper Networks devices and for Cisco devices. There's a list on the Windows Azure site. And with those, you can go and configure your router to go and integrate with the Windows Azure network. With that, and with IIS, you can now go and create 10, 15, 20, 30, 50, 100 machines and map them into your own network. You can domain join them, and you can treat them effectively as if were running on your own network. So you take your network, and you take the Windows Azure network, and you fuse them together, and they act as one network. The Windows Azure machines can see yours, and your machine can see the Windows Azure machines. You make one space out of it. You make one environment, and that's what the Windows Azure virtual network does. And those machines still have connectivity out to the front. So what you can do with that is if you are running a public website and you're running out of your own data center and suddenly you need more capacity for it for the holiday season, well, then add 50 machines out of Windows Azure, right, and set them up in the same way, and then you have a farm that's spread across across these two facilities. Or make it across three or four facilities because you can go and target into the other networks as well. Or into the other data centers as well. Then there's Windows Azure Connect. That's still in beta. Not clear whether we're going to take that forward. That's something that's currently available. You can go and install an agent, kind of make a VPN tunnel from machine to machine rather than fusing two networks together. So Windows the virtual network is currently available for Windows Server. I forgot that. So Juniper Network devices, Cisco devices, and Windows Server. The VPN functionality, and that's for binding networks together, and it's kind of native in the native VPN infrastructure, and the Windows Azure Connect requires a little agent that runs on the machine and goes and integrates through that, and that allows single machine point-to-point connections. On the application layer, when you simply want to go and integrate apps, and that's what most of you will want to do when you're developing, we have Service Bus, and Service Bus, that's what I work on. That's the infrastructure that's there to go and create those kinds of integrations between cloud and on-premises, specifically built to let apps talk. And then there's SQL Data Sync. If you have two databases, one is on-premises and one is in the cloud, and you want to go and sync between them, you can set up a data sync relationship, and then the data gets synchronized. So the goal is, let me go and skip this because I would just want to go and talk about the Service Bus scenarios. Before I do that, Traffic Manager. Traffic Manager is also interesting for your for this hybrid scenarios, because what that allows you to do is kind of have a rules-based distribution of traffic as it comes in, not only into Windows Azure, but also other sites. It's a standalone service. What that allows you to do is to kind of see what the client, where the client comes from, what country they come from. There's rules. There's some geo-sensing there. And then go to one of the hosted services, and that hosted service might be in your country and in your own data center, but it may also be in the cloud. So if you're setting up an environment where you have your own data center here and you have invested in that and you want to keep running it, but you need to have extra capacity in other places, in other continents, you could set up that infrastructure in the cloud as a copy of the systems that you have and have traffic manager effectively balanced either to you or to the other facilities based on where the clients are coming from. So that's another story where you have not the integrated, necessarily integrated story that's hybrid, but you have a horizontally scaled story that's hybrid. And then lastly, let me recap some of the things that I talked about in the service bus talk, because now they're in a bit of a different context. So we have some retail services, ISVs, and they're using service bus to go and do that integration. VPN is cool, but VPN is also heavy because it changes your networking environment, right? You are required to go and change your networking environment to do that integration. If the integration is really only one app trying to go and integrate with another app that sits somewhere else, changing the network environment may be very intrusive. Also, making a VPN tunnel requires that you actually have firewall rights to establish that VPN tunnel with that particular protocol, so you need to get through. That's not the case everywhere. For instance, in point-of-sale environments. Point-of-sale environments, you have a mall or some big department store, and you have a pop-up shop inside of that department store, and you want to sell clothes. You have to use whatever network is there. That's Wi-Fi or something that someone gives you a cable. You can't change that network environment. You have no power to do that. Maybe you can't even VPN through. Right? For instance, from Microsoft, I can't do a VPN connection from Microsoft to the outside world because Microsoft says, I want to be in control, but I want to see what you're doing. So what they do in bed-in shop systems, for instance, is they use service bus queues. They set up a queue which takes the inbound traffic, and that goes into Windows Azure, and they have a topic where they have subscriptions that the subscriptions deliver the outbound traffic to those individual points of sales. So the point of sale machine now only has connectivity in internet, you know, post, in the simplest case, HTTP, a post to put some messages into the queue, and a get, well, actually, it's a post with some else, so it's a little bit more complicated. But a very simple HTTP operation, so get into a queue and from a queue, and from that queue, from that messaging infrastructure, the data gets forwarded further. We can also do that over a protocol called AMQP, which is very open. And that AMQP protocol allows you to do that over, for instance, Java or whatever your client is written with. So that's another way, a completely alternative way, to go and build that kind of integration to leverage Service Bus, to leverage the Service Bus infrastructure for this. I'm going to skip this because I talked about that. And then let me talk about another scenario, which is also hybrid in some sense, where we have CRM Online. CRM Online runs, obviously, in the cloud. So that's a customer relationship management system, which you can get from Microsoft. And they run that. The CRM folks run that for you. But they have the need to push information, push notifications about things that are happening, new leads and change of address and all kinds of things, to the respective customer representatives. And the way they're going to do that is through the push notification service that we have, the notification hub, in Service Bus, which now delivers those things kind of onto the devices. And that's also a complementary scenario to the hybrid scenarios, where the hybrid, the on-premises component, on-premises in quotes, is actually your phone. So Service Bus is all about bridging between applications. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I can't give you more. I'll have to tell you to actually watch the recording. If you haven't seen it, watch the recording of the Service Bus talk that I gave earlier this today for all the details. I'm going to go and skip some of those slides and get to that slide because we're out of time. And the question is, what is the name of the Service Bus component that could be used to integrate client applications with on-premises system under NAT? Now, That's unfair now because I skipped that portion. So I will have to give you the answer. The thing that you can use to expose services through NATs is the relay. That's a service that it can use to effectively host any web service anywhere and expose that out. We actually heard someone, I told you the story about someone using it, and that is EasyJet. So EasyJet is using that relay to take an existing web service that they have and expose it out to the cloud so that it can then be consumed. So that is your answer for A10, is relay. I hope it's the right answer. I didn't write that question. So then, let me say it's a few closing words. If you're thinking about hybrid applications, if you're thinking about building cloud applications, they will almost invariably be some form of hybrid, because you have existing applications, existing assets somewhere in an office. You have existing assets somewhere which are, you know, field deployed devices. You have kiosks. You have all kinds of things that are sitting outside in the field that are helping human beings to do something. And as we're getting more devices out in the field, more and more of those applications will be hybrid. Taking a look at messaging specifically, so taking a look at Service Bus, but just feel free to also go and look at other messaging systems, is something that's a core component for building these hybrid solutions. Knowing how a queue works, and knowing what a queue does, and knowing what a topic does, and how subscriptions work is key to building these kinds of applications. And it's also key to building resilient applications that can survive, that can go when things go down, and that you can go and run where you want to run updates, when you want to have downtime and certain components. If you want to run a big distributed system, then using queues for that, using decoupling for that, is actually very, very helpful. And if you have existing infrastructure, if you have existing workloads, actually going and taking a look at the VPN options that we have, specifically the new Windows Azure Virtual Network, that will help you to kind of fuse the environments together and make them one environment that looks, combines the cloud very naturally together with the on-premises systems. I hope that was somewhat enlightening or interesting, kind of show you some of the options that we have in Windows Azure and how we run some parts of how we run Windows Azure. And that was my last talk. And I would like to thank you for having me here in Russia. And it's a great honor. And I will hope that I will be back soon. Thank you.